This is the first day of this October 2011 7-day session. Just a little notice, I came down with a cold last night, so this teisha will be something in the way of an experiment. Might be a little shorter than usual. I'm going to be reading from a text we last read from about 3 years ago called Zen Dawn. And what it is a collection of early Zen texts from the Dunhuang Caves. This book is translated by J.C. Cleary. The Dunhuang Caves are becoming increasingly well known. They're in the on the edge of the Gobi Desert, what is now China, and it was in the last century, the 20th century, that these caves were discovered, and immense treasures of Buddha figures and ancient texts were found there. It had been preserved over the centuries by the very arid climate of the desert. And the material in this book are from those Dunhuang Caves. So these in the introduction, we're told that these texts date from the early 700s. And that they're among the earliest surviving records of Chan Buddhism in China, or Zen Buddhism. The book opens with a preface by a certain monk that we're going to skip over. And the first section is called Records of the Teachers and Students of the Lanka. Begins with it's a series of short biographies. The second one is Bodhidharma, but the one before it, this first one, is of Gunabhadra of the Sung period. Now, just in case anyone might get confused, there's a later Sung dynasty, and there's a much earlier Sung dynasty. And it begins, Gunabhadra Tripitaka was a man of South India. So, like, in that respect, the same as Bodhidharma. When he studied the great vehicle, that is, the Mahayana, he was called Mahayana. He came by ship to Guangzhou in the early part of the 400s, 424 to 454. The emperor received him, and he translated the Lankavatara Sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra is one of the most highly regarded of all the sutras, one of the most highly regarded in Zen. The Lankavatara Sutra, the Diamond Sutra, the Sharangama Sutra, the Platform Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, and we're told that Bodhidharma was especially fond of the Lankavatara Sutra. It has quite a bit of Buddhist psychology in it, and to my knowledge, there still is no full translation of the Lankavatara Sutra, although there's a big hunk of it in a book called A Buddhist Bible. goes on here, princes and nobles, monks and laymen invited him to give instructions on meditation. But Guna Bahadra was embarrassed and declined because he did not speak Chinese well. That night he dreamed that a man cut off his head with a sword. Thenceforth, he began to give lessons on meditation. You know, this translation is written in a quite a spare style, and sometimes just raises questions in what it says. Guna Bahadra said, "This country is located in the east and lacks methods of cultivating the path." Now, this is the very beginning of Zen in China, and until this time, there wasn't in China there wasn't what we call Zen or Chan. He goes on, this is still quoting Guna Bahadra, "Since they lack such methods, some fall into the teachings of the lesser vehicle and the two vehicles. Some fall into the teachings of the 95 kinds of outside paths. Some fall into demonic meditation in order to view all things and find out the good and bad deeds of other people." How bitter! What a great misfortune! They entrap themselves and entrap others. I feel sorry for these types who fall for long ages into demonic paths subject to birth and death and do not attain liberation. Of course, we all know that there are many kinds of meditation, and probably more now than ever. And here, Guna Bahadra is issuing a warning about how the mind can be misused. It's hard to know for sure what he means by demonic paths, but we could probably say for sure that it means any number of different kinds of mind states. This is what's so radical about Zen meditation, is that we have no use for states of mind. Let me clarify. Zen is not about getting into any particular state of mind. We're trying to see through states of mind, every kind of state of mind. States of rapture, states of bliss, states of psychic powers, paranormal powers. These different states really don't lead to liberation. Liberation is something different from magical states of mind. But he elaborates here. "Some fall into forbidden magical arts, controlling spirits and demons, spying on other people's good and bad deeds. They falsely say, 'I sit in meditation and practice contemplation.'" That's the end of Guna Bahadra quoting these guys. And then he continues, "Ordinary people are blind and deluded and do not understand, and think that such magicians have indeed realized the path of the sages and submit to them. They do not know that these are perverse, demonic methods." Again, the word demonic can sound a little bit overblown, but to the extent that we allow such states of mind, even though they're not malevolent states, to the extent to which we allow them to captivate us, then they work against us, work against our enlightenment. He goes on, in our land we have the correct teaching, but it is secret and not openly transmitted. Those who have an affinity with it and whose faculties are fully prepared meet good and wise people on the road who bestow it on them. If not for encounters with good and wise teachers, there would be no transmission. The correct teaching. This can sound, parts of this text can sound like one-upmanship. You know, we have the correct way, and all others are lesser ways. I think what correct teaching really means is the teaching that sees through all forms. These so-called demonic states, states of mind, these are in the realm of form. They're trying to create something. In Zen, we're not trying to create anything. We're trying to see through all things, all mind states, all illusion. To put it another way, at every step of this way, Zen, we need to discard whatever is hanging in the mind. Zen is a practice of losing. It's a practice of letting go. So when we call it a correct teaching, it's really a no teaching. It's not a teaching of any ordinary kind. It's letting go of all notions that there's anything we have to learn, that there's anything we need to acquire. That's what makes it a correct teaching. In other words, we have to get rid of any notion of this being a correct teaching. Then he quotes the Lankavatara Sutra. The mind of the Buddhas is supreme. When the Dharma is bestowed in our teaching, where deluded states of mind do not arise, it is this. The mind of the Buddha is supreme. In other words, Buddha nature, Buddha mind, with which we are all endowed equally, this mind is supreme. And where states of mind do not arise, it is this. So it's the absence of anything going on in the mind. And then Guru Bahadra continues, this Dharma surpasses the three vehicles and goes beyond the 10 stages. Ultimately, the fruit of enlightenment can only be known for oneself with mind silent. No-minded, we nurture the spirit. Without thought, we pacify the body. Without preoccupations, we sit in purity, preserving the fundamental and returning to the real. Our Dharma is secret and silent. It is not transmitted by common fools of shallow consciousness. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. When he says our Dharma is secret, this also can be misleading. There's nothing to be concealed from anyone. If it's secret, it's an open secret. It's this. This. What's secret about this? Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it and carry it out. Most of us in Zen have heard the famous story of Bodhidharma's meeting the emperor, and the emperor telling him proudly how much he had, all the good deeds he had done, building temples and supporting monks. And then asking Bodhidharma, what merit is there in this? And Bodhidharma replying, no merit whatsoever. And most people, I'm coming to learn, people get caught by that response, and they misunderstand it. They think that, okay, there's no such thing as merit. But there is. Bodhidharma was answering in one way. He was answering from the absolute perspective. No merit whatsoever. Vast emptiness, he said, and nothing that can be called holy. But that's just half the truth. The other half is the world of relativity, which means merit. There's a place for merit. When we do things that help others, we're accumulating merit. When we respond selflessly to serve others, we're accumulating merit. When we're upholding the precepts, we're accumulating merit. And this merit accumulates and enables us to meet with fortunate circumstances, such as the Dharma. And that's what he's saying here. Only people rich in merit and virtue can receive it, the Dharma, and carry it out. So we mustn't get attached to this notion of this realm of beyond merit, beyond virtue. Everything we do, every move we make, every word we speak is either creating merit or not. It's just another word for karma. Favorable karma or unfavorable karma. It matters how we conduct ourselves in our lives, our daily lives, at work, at home, in traffic. It matters. He goes on, this is still Guna Bahadra, those who intend to be Buddhas should first learn to pacify mind. Before mind is pacified, even good things are not good. So much the worse for evil. Let's just pause here and comment. Pacify mind, it's not the word I would choose. It sounds passive. I think a better word is to those who intend to be Buddhists should first learn to let the mind settle. That's what we're doing now, here, this hour, in Teisho. The mind, little by little, is starting to settle as a result of doing all this sitting. Before mind settles, even good things are not good. Well, he may mean that so-called good deeds, virtuous deeds, are not really virtuous. Why? Because if the mind is agitated, if the ego is still dominating the mind, then whatever may appear to be virtuous on the outside is not truly virtuous, not truly good. When mind becomes peaceful and still, neither good nor evil has any basis. All right, so this is in this realm of samadhi. There are no such categories in the mind. There are no such notions as good and evil, merit and lack of merit. He continues, since coming to this country, I have not even seen people who cultivate the path, much less anyone who has pacified mind. So this is really the dawn of Zen practice in China. He says he hasn't even seen people doing Zazen. I often see people who go along creating karma, who have not merged with the path. Some are concerned with fame and reputation. Some act for the sake of profit and support. They operate with the mentality of self and other. They act with the attitude of jealousy. What is jealousy? It means to engender the mentality of resentment and hatred when you see someone else cultivating the path and reaching realization in principle and practice, so that many people offer support and give their allegiance. It means self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence, not using it to overcome self. This is called jealousy. It's a funny, the second one is kind of funny. Use of the word jealousy, self-satisfied reliance on your own intelligence. When doing prostrations, whether here in the Zendo or the Kanon room or in the Doksan room, when doing prostrations, we are lowering this self-satisfied reliance on our own intelligence, our own intellect. We're putting it in its place to overcome self, ego. He continues, even if you scrupulously perform various practices day and night, cut off afflictions and clear away obstructions, with this kind of attitude, barriers to the path arise one after another, and you do not find peace and stillness. This is just called cultivating the path. It is not called pacifying mind. Back to prostrations. It can take some people quite a while to appreciate what's behind this ancient ritual. If we can just follow along and do prostrations when with everyone else, we will come to appreciate how it changes us, at least changes us at that moment that we're doing the prostration. It's hard to be proud and arrogant while doing a prostration. You might be able to pull it off, but it's harder when you're lowering your head to the floor. In Korean Zen, it's standard practice, first thing in the morning when you get up, every day, to do 108 prostrations. 108 is, it reflects some kind of a formula of human afflictions, but it's not important, 108, but it's just, okay, why? It's one number to settle on, 108. And I've heard from people at our Zen teachers' meetings, our annual Zen teachers' meetings, the very few representatives of Korean Zen report that it is really a marvelous practice. It opens the heart. That's why it's part of Doksan. In Zen, we're always striving to move from the abstract to the concrete. And by that I mean, in this case, rather than just thinking, trying to think thoughts or sort of get yourself into a humble mood, that's just all abstract, to actually do a prostration. Embody it is far, far better. We may not understand with the mind what we're doing exactly or the benefits of it by doing it over and over and over, it does change us. The same with offerings on the altar, the fruit or vegetable that's on the altar, the flowers, the incense. This is a question that often comes up in introductory workshops. I'm sitting addressing the group in front of the altar, and someone may look over my shoulder and say, what's that fruit? What's the purpose of that fruit or the flowers on the altar? It's not so easy to explain this, but to help them accept it, I will sometimes try, as I will now. Really, the Buddha on the altar really represents our own Buddha nature. And the more we can open ourselves to this concrete, this lacquered wood representation of our true nature, the more we tend to form a bond with our own Buddha nature. It's a way of cultivating a sense of faith in who we really are. We're not, as George Bernard Shaw said, just a feverish clod of ailments and grievances. We are what is represented by this beautiful figure on the altar. Every one of us is, equally. And making physical offerings is a way of cultivating a sense of faith that this is who we really are. It's a lot better than just murmuring to ourselves that, okay, from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. That's something also that cultivates that. When we do it aloud in our recitation of the Hakuin chant, but there are different ways of doing this. So we do that right before Taisho each day, from the very beginning all beings are Buddha. And this is another way to have assembled an altar with the most beautiful cloth, candles, beautiful flower arrangement, an offering of squash or grapes or whatever is in season, incense. All of these things together create, they all support practice. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. In other words, it's practical. It's not just hocus pocus. It's actual. It works. It's part of the method. It's part of the tradition. And it's part of the tradition because it works. In subtle ways, not necessarily anything we can understand, but it's just part of the tradition. And if we can have faith in the tradition, it'll work for us. Gunabhadra continues, even if you practice the six paramitas, expound the sutras, sit in meditation, and advance energetically, practicing austerities, this is just called being good. It is not called dharma practice. If you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called dharma practice. So it's really fundamentally Zen is not about trying to do something or add something or create some effect. It's refraining from getting in the way of our nature. This is what is so confounding about it, that we really, Zen meditation, unlike many other kinds, has nothing to do with creating any effects. In fact, you could say we're not trying to reform ourselves, we're not even trying to change ourselves. We don't have to try any of that. We just have to get out of the way by letting the mind settle. Starts with getting beyond our cravings, or not contributing to our cravings with our thoughts. if you do not irrigate the karmic field with the water of desire or craving, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness there, this is called Dharma practice. Strictly speaking, from a Buddhist perspective, we can't really speak about good karma. We can speak of bad karma, we can speak of obstructive karma, but ultimately, it's either karma or no karma. Karma is understood as a negative thing, as an obstructive thing. So so-called good karma is just the absence of generating more karma that binds us to the wheel of life, to the wheel of suffering. That's what he means when he says, if you do not plant the seeds of consciousness in the karmic field, this is called Dharma practice. It gets into a new little section here, a new kind of topic. So I think it's time now to stop, and we'll recite the four vows.